singing all right. Folks, going to have a little fun right here with names and imagery. Yep, when I say the Partridge Family, which images come quickly to mind? Well, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm guessing you're the same, a pretty widowed mom with her fresh-scrubbed sons and daughters singing to their and our heart's delight. Millions of us, yes, millions, invited Shirley Jones and David Cassidy and the others into our homes back in the 1970s, and their impact was so great that those images are still vivid in our minds. For the next few minutes, we are going to delve deeply into this beloved television musical sitcom, into the characters and the talented cast that portrayed these characters, and of course, their music, too. That's a huge piece. As our centerpiece, we have a recent biography. It's titled When We're Singing. In fact, funny how the coincidence come along. That's the song we're hearing in the background. The name, When We're Singing, the Partridge Family and their music. The author is Johnny Ray Miller. And guess what, folks? Johnny Ray is on the line right now to take us on some full immersion of the Partridge Clan. Well, Johnny Ray, welcome and thank you for joining us today. Great book, my friend.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a delight. I have been enjoying your book. You know, it's a heavy tome, as you well know. I think it's about 2 inches. I haven't measured it. But my biceps...
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Right. My biceps look a lot better since I've been lugging that book around.
But I have to tell you, the funniest thing, when I saw David Cassidy for the first time after the book was done, I met up with him, and I handed him the book, and, you know, he had already had a copy, but I wanted to get my picture with him, you know, and all of this. And so we were talking, and he has a very, like, sarcastic, dry sense of humor. So he loved the book, you know, he supported it, he wrote a foreword for it and the whole nine yards. Yep. And at one point he looks at me really seriously and says, "I only have one issue with this." And I thought, and he said it real serious, you know, and I thought, oh my God, what did I do? You know, because the book is a real tribute to the show, and I'm thinking, oh God, what did I do? He looks at me, and he's holding the book, and he starts sort of hovering it up and down, and he looks at me and real slowly says, "It's heavy."
I love it.
And it was the way he said it that was just, it was just so funny. But that seems to be the response that I get when people, you know, get the book and they call me. They kind of can't believe how big it is.
Yeah. But you get also the sense that it's heavy, man. In other words, it's really good. And it
yeah,
is.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, that's so his sense of humor. It just, it was great. You know, I will always remember that.
It's good to know that's still intact. At 2 inches thick, your book really is a real doorstopper. And it's a showstopper, too. It is certain to be the definitive work on the Partridge. Yeah, really, Johnny, great job. Johnny, can I call you Johnny Ray or Johnny? Which do you like?
Oh, yeah, Johnny's fine.
Johnny's fine. Johnny, you were born, by my arithmetic, just a few years before the show, The Partridge Family, first aired. So what got you so interested in doing this full-scale biography?
Well, yeah, that's funny you say that. I was actually just kind of short of the right age for The Partridge Family, and I didn't really find it, discover the show till towards the end of its run, but it stayed with me like I think it did for so many all through my whole life. It's and especially the music. It was always the music that I would go to. It was always my go-to music. And then, you know, the internet breaks out in the 90s, and pretty soon you find out there's all these people out there who also feel the same way. And pretty soon people are saying, you know, where's the Partridge Family unreleased songs? Where's a book on the Partridge Family? And I was one of the diehard fans who was saying it right along with everybody else. And, you know, we waited and waited and waited, and nobody did a book. And there were some people who could do a book. There was a book. It was an episode guide that came out in the mid-90s by Joey Green. But it was an episode thing. You know how they did a lot of those in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't really the story of the Partridge Family in so much as it was a fun kind of quick factoid thing that went episode by episode. But nobody ever delved into the music at all. And even in all of the biographies that we would see on television, documentaries, never do they touch on the music. They just say, "Oh, I Think I Love You was the number one song in 1970, and they had smash records." But pretty soon, people were, you know, wanting to hear about the music and, you know, why is this music so good? It's colored by that image of the TV show, and it was tagged as bubblegum to market the music. But really, this music was produced by some of the greatest songwriters of the day and the musicians that played on it. And then they discovered David Cassidy has this amazing voice, and, you know, you package it all together. And actually, what's kind of interesting to me is the Partridge Family did better on the easy listening charts and the soft rock category than even on the pop charts.
Mm-hmm. I noticed
which
that.
I think
I noticed that and looked
says
at
a lot. Yeah,
yeah. We're gonna delve deeply into some of these songs in just a bit, Johnny. Fascinating. You know, it's one of the great aspects of your book is you do give equal weight to both the characters, both on air and off air. The characters, the Partridge Family, and the music, which is hugely important, as you say. You do what all good biographers, good authors do. You go to the primary sources. You got to David Cassidy, as you mentioned. He wrote the foreword to your book, and you got to everybody who was really a central figure in the story of the Partridge Family, at least those still with us. Ringing them up and hoping to get interviews with them. I love your story where I believe you got David Cassidy to go along and help you with this. And you had called Shirley Jones, and you made the call, and you're waiting, and you're waiting, and you're waiting. And I believe you were in a supermarket checkout line taking care of your oranges and your hot dogs and all the rest, and your cell goes
yeah, right.
off. And tell us about that, John.
Yeah. Well, I had just worked at this theater, which is where my background was, and booked David Cassidy, and it was a phenomenally successful thing. And having been a fan, I thought, you know, everybody's still talking about, why doesn't somebody write a book? And I kind of had a little bit of background in writing, and I thought, you know, I've got a lot of people who would support me in this, and I feel as though I have David Cassidy now. If I need Shirley Jones, and if I can get her, I'll take that as a sign to keep going. So I had contacted her office, and at that point, her now late husband, Marty Engels, was managing her. And I had had a couple of exchanges with him. We were talking about bringing her into the theater as a follow-up act shortly before I left there. So I had known him from, you know, the telephone and the email a little bit. And I contacted him, and we talked a couple of times, and then I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. 3 weeks or so went by, and I thought, you know, this just isn't going to happen. And I'm at a department store, a grocery store checkout line, mm-hmm. and I'm the next one up. I mean, she's, you know, running my groceries mm-hmm. through the thing, mm-hmm. and my cell phone rings, and this was when I still had I always have an old cell phone. So I had like an old flip top phone with no camera on it, yeah. and you know,
sounds like
there
me.
Was no, not like it is now with, mm-hmm. with the iPhone.
Right.
And so I just flipped it and I didn't recognize the number. Well, actually I think it probably said private. I don't really remember. I just remember answering it and hearing this voice going, "Hi, John, this is Shirley Jones." How would you react?
I'd drop
would
my
you
groceries.
Pay for your groceries?
I'd drop the whole bag.
I dropped everything. I just walked away from her. I was so stunned. I didn't even say goodbye. Of course, I didn't take the groceries, but I just, there she is running my groceries through, and I just walk away and go out onto the sidewalk, and, you know, I'm trying to keep myself composed on the outside, and she's talking to me, and, you know, I'm thinking on the inside, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah.
And we talked for, I don't know, 10 minutes, and that's how it all got started, and, you know, she invited me to sit down with her, and she was very supportive of it.
Oh.
And one of the first things she said to me was, you know, I cannot believe somebody has not done this before now.
That's true.
And she said, you know, I'll do anything to support you and help you get this off the ground.
Oh, boy, you were off the launch pad with that one, Johnny. Once again, we want to say we're talking with Johnny Ray Miller, author of When We're Singing, The Partridge Family and Their Music. The book came out last year. It is a winner, start to finish. It's got a middle section. It's huge pictorially. Great color photographs, some from the scrapbooks of some of the players, some of the kids who were then kids in the Partridge Family series. And, Johnny, it ran from 1970, first run, 1970 to 74. And on the off chance that some folks don't know or have forgotten the premise of the program, just in a sentence or two, what was it all about? What was the basic premise of the show?
Yeah, it was about a widowed mother who is talked into by her children being in their band setting in, actually just sitting in for one of the girls up the street who got sick and couldn't be there. So then Danny takes the recording out, and, you know, he's 10 years old, and he shops around for a manager because he was the business mind. That was kind of the comedy of the pilot, and comes back with a contract. And so that launches the series, and it becomes the family, you know, that sings together and stays together kind of a thing, traveling around in their Mondrian-inspired painted bus that everybody, you know, remembers and loves. I mean, who wouldn't watch that? Who wouldn't want that to be, you know, life in some way?
And we have to remember, too, Johnny, this was a period when the Vietnam War was still grinding on, and people needed some comic relief, something lighter in their life. And the Partridge
Family
did that beautifully.
You know,
too.
One of the producers told me that that was part of what they were after, was to merge. There was such a generation gap. And, in fact, the original design of the bus decided on by Bernard Slade, who created the series, was altered by the producers. He originally envisioned it as a sort of 60s hippie van kind of a thing, with the psychedelic colors. And one of the producers really liked the artwork and collected artwork of P.A. Mondrian and sort of morphed it into that whole Mondrian style. But what he told me was that they were really after trying to merge the two groups so that you would still draw in the kids and the kids would like it and not feel, you know, not go in a rebellious way, but also not feel like it was square. And the parents would embrace it.
Well, I think it worked. It the demographics of the show that the mission accomplished, no doubt about it.
Johnny, that's
fascinating. So we've got the premise of the show, in case anybody had forgotten. I doubt that. John, let's talk about the origin, the inspiration, maybe, for the show. We often hear the Cowsills, a real-life family singing group. I think out of, Rhode Island, I think they came from, had a lot of love hits. And they usually are singled out as the single inspiration. But your book points out there are probably two others. At least the Von Trapp family and another, which you can tell us in just a minute. But I've got to tell you a personal anecdote. The Cowsills have come through here the last two summers at the Minnesota State Fair. And you know them. They're wonderful. They're great performers.
Yeah.
They've had a lot of tragedy.
They are.
A lot of tragedy in their lives, the family. But those remaining Cowsills are still great performers. But they always open their act, at least they did the two times I saw them, last year and the year before, by saying, well, you know about us and the Partridge Family. We would have been the Partridge Family. Would have been the Cowsill Family. But I guess we had too many zits. And maybe we weren't strong in terms of our profile on camera. And it was not an unkind shot at Shirley Jones. It was kind of a shot at the producers. But certainly the Cowsills were part of the inspiration for the Partridge Family.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, in telling you the story, I'll slip in a story that a little bit more of an elaborate story that I left out in the book, and hope I won't get in trouble. But
oh, go ahead.
Yeah. The reason the Cowsills are so associated as the inspiration is because not only did they influence the TV show creator, but they also influenced the music. And the funny thing is that two different people had two different ideas that came together as one. Bernard Slade was the creator of the show, and he told me that he always wanted to do a show about the singing family. And he toyed around with it. He was contracted to write three pilots a year with Screen Gems. And the first thing he did that sort of had that idea in his mind was something he did up in Canada called the Big Coin Sound, and it was a variety show. Then he comes down to the States. Everybody was in love with the Sound of Music during that period, and he loved this idea of the singing family. But the trigger to write it was one night he was watching The Tonight Show, and he saw the Cowsills on there, and the thing that got him was that they made records. So he made a point of telling me, because I said to him when we interviewed, I said, you know, I understand that, you know, the Cowsills were the inspiration. He emphatically said the Cowsills were not the inspiration. They were one. Mm-hmm. They were the trigger that, you know, had me sit down and write it. They were one of three influences. So I really wanted to write it that way. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that happened was that he had this idea and they scripted this pilot. But none of them had any idea what this music was going to sound like, or how to do it, or who to call. So the music kind of became a thing in its own entity that merged it together, and that's why it became so, to me, so phenomenally successful, and that the music was so credible. It started out with Shorty Rogers producing the pilot. He had a jazz background, and he didn't really have a background in making hits, but he had a tremendous background in working on movies and being easy to work with. But he didn't really feel comfortable, I don't think, was the feeling I got here. He was gone. I couldn't really talk to him. But his one son I spoke with, and a couple of others who worked with him, said that he wasn't the right guy to make hits, and he kind of knew that, and he sort of stepped aside. Meanwhile, they didn't go find Wes Farrell. Wes Farrell already had his fingers on the pulse. Wes Farrell was a guy who produced and wrote, you know, Hang On Sloopy was his biggest hit, with Burt Burns, and a couple of other hits in the late 60s with Bobby Hart, Come a Little Bit Closer and Come On Down to My Boat. So he always wanted to, he had this thing called sighting to sound. That was the language he used. Basically, it was a really early vision for MTV. He wanted to do music for a television show and sync it together so that the music would match the image. So he heard about the Partridge Family, and he was already, according to John Baylor, he was already listening in and watching in to the episode, the creation of the pilot, and he went to the producers and said, hey, he was very New York. He was very, he, you know,
that's why he said, hey.
Yeah, hey. He's like, hey, you want hits or not? If you want hits, then you need me. Yeah, so they get him, you know, he had a way. He was strong personality, and he had a way of getting in there and proving himself. So he comes in full force with his vision, and that is why you see a difference in the music on the pilot than the music that it eventually becomes, because Wes Farrell, it was Wes Farrell's idea to have David Cassidy really sing, to test him out.
David initially was going to be lip-syncing until he went to the producers and said, hey, man, I can sing. Shirley Jones can sing, and I can sing. And they relented and let David sing. So no lip-syncing.
Yeah, that's so right. Now, the producers were told, back then, producers didn't have control of a pilot until they sold the pilot. Then they would get more control of the TV show. But with the pilot, Bob Claver made a, he was the executive producer, and he made a big point of telling me that, you know, you have to fight the executives to get what you want during that stage. So one of the things they insisted on is that these guys all go visit the real life Cow Sills. So Bob Claver and Bernard Slade together went back east to visit the Cow Sills, and their take on it, Bob Claver is very, he doesn't mince words. You know, and he basically said to me that the Cow Sills, they had terrific singing voices, but the only one that had any screen appeal for them was the little girl. He felt that all of the others did not work well on camera and they couldn't act. So he abandoned the idea quickly, and I guess they shot some footage and brought it back, and at that point the executive said, okay.
No thank you, Cow Sills.
Yeah. You know, you can't diss the Cow Sills because they weren't actors. I mean, they're tremendous singers. But, you know, it was just a thing where it wasn't going to work. They figured that out. Bob Claver was a really strong executive producer with a background in some really successful TV shows. He started out on Captain Kangaroo. Yeah. And, he was a great producer.
Well, obviously he was, and he knew camera appeal when he saw it, screen appeal. Here we are. Well, I hope Johnny Ray Miller, can you stay with us for a while this afternoon? We got a lot of ground to cover. You've got a wonderful book. The book we're talking about the Partridge Family, When We're Singing, The Partridge Family and Their Music. Now, the first theme song for the TV sitcom was When We're Singing. We opened our show, the segment, with it here at 1 o'clock. And the second theme song to come along was Come On, Get Happy. And I don't know, we'll get that along the way here. We're going to set it right here. Bobby, let's hear a bit of Come On, Get Happy, the second theme for the Partridge Family. We'll take a commercial break, and we'll be back in just a minute with Johnny Ray Miller.
A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy. We had a dream we'd go traveling together. We spread a little love and it will keep moving on. Something always happens whenever we're together. We get a happy feeling when we're singing a song. Traveling along, there's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of
Hey, you've heard of National Night Out, right? But have you ever heard of National Noon Out? Well, they're having a National Noon Out on Tuesday, August 1st at Scandia Shores of Shoreview, a superior independent living facility for seniors. You and your friends are invited to attend and enjoy the games and the free lunch. National Noon Out is your chance to meet your neighbors and make new friends. What's more, you can rub elbows with local government officials, firefighters, police officers, and other first responders who will be on hand taking part in all the festivities. While you're there at Scandia Shores, take a look around. Talk to the friendly staff. See for yourself why it's considered the area's most exceptional independent living facility for those 55 years of age and older. You can also make an appointment to tour the facilities. Once again, plan to attend Tuesday, August 1st from 11:30 to 1:30 p.m. at Scandia Shores of Shoreview. For more information, call 651-415-9793. That's 651-415-9793.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
There we are. We're back with our show focusing on the Partridge family right now. It's 123 in the cities, 82 degrees in the metro right now. We're having a ball talking with Johnny Ray Miller. He's talking to us, I believe, from his home in Youngstown, Ohio right now. His book, you've got to read it. It's a must read. When We're Singing, the Partridge Family and Their Music. Johnny, again, thank you so much for having written the book. Thank you for being with us right now. Where do we get your book? How can we get a hold of it?
Oh, thank you so much for the kind words. You can get the book through the website, whenweresingin.com. There's no G on the end of the website either. It's just whenweresingin.com.
Okay. We're getting a lot of calls, as we knew we would. People want to know, well, we touched on it, but we'll get into it deeply here, about who was actually singing when you saw the Partridge Family singing, quote unquote. Who was actually singing? Who was lip syncing? And were they really playing the kids? Were they really playing those instruments? We'll get into that in just a minute, but I know a lot of our listeners, if not most of them, all of them maybe, want to know, give us an update, would you, on the stars of the show. David Cassidy was always billed as the Partridge Family featuring David Cassidy, but starring Shirley Jones. Give us an update, Johnny, if you would please, on David Cassidy. We've heard some troubling things about him. Obviously, he was a big star, a teenage heartthrob during the years of the show. If you could, just kind of give us a summary of where he's been and where he is now.
Yeah, sure. David Cassidy, he did break out, you know, of course, and have a tremendous solo career. He's made over 20 albums as a solo artist, let alone the 10 that came out as the Partridge Family. And he's had a really devout following through the years. His fan base is very, very devoted and devout. He has been out touring since 2000. He's been doing concerts all the time, all over the place. And recently, he just came out on an episode of Dr. Phil in February. He had some trouble that was pretty evident at a concert in Agora Hills in California. And, you know, people were talking about it, and so 3 days later he was on Dr. Phil, and he comes out and basically tells the world he has early onset dementia and that he had been diagnosed with it 2 years prior to this and has been, you know, basically trying to keep it quiet until he had to come out with it. And so the time came, and he's out with it, and but you know, he's in really good spirits. He went back into the studio. He recorded some Christmas songs that were available only as EP download at Christmas, and he's doing the same now. He has more songs coming out. I think it might even be titled something like Songs My Father Taught Me.
No?
So he's out there still doing it. He says he's not going to go away. It's not taken strong hold of him yet, and people are hoping that he'll be out there still doing more concerts down the road.
Yes, Johnny, but of course, we know too that David went through a low period. He had some problems with chemicals, with alcohol in the past, and I think he wound up on the cover of, was it Rolling Stone magazine, something like that.
Actually, the Rolling Stone cover was something he did in the mid in 1972 in an attempt to kind of break the image. He was always troubled by the image that was attached to him as Keith Partridge.
Remind us what the image was on the cover of Rolling Stone, please.
Oh, yeah. It was a nude photo of him all the way down, you know, showing just enough to be legal.
It was cropped just in time.
Yeah, just in time. And he did it intentionally. He was trying to, you know, he wanted to be taken seriously, and he wanted to express himself as an artist. And he will say today, you know, it's one of the things he did that he's still most proud of, because I think he was looking for, you know, he wanted to see who was interested in him as David Cassidy and not the image of Keith Partridge, which was very likable, you know, but it was a television character.
Sure.
And his launch was through the television character. And I think some of those guys who do launch from television shows have the hardest time busting out of that image.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I always joke about is if you put a Partridge Family CD into a CD mix with Elton John and Rod Stewart, and you mix it up and you play it at a party, I guarantee you people are going to listen to that, like it, and ask you who it is. But the minute you say Partridge Family, it's like, oh, you're kidding me. And it's because that image is so attached, but that music and David Cassidy's voice was incredible. But, you know, as I point this out in the book, the image at some point became almost stronger than anything else. When he appeared nude on the cover of Rolling Stone, I guess that was the highest selling issue until Lennon's death. The reaction to his young girl followers was that wasn't real.
Oh.
So they just dismissed it.
I see.
It didn't even put a dent in what people thought of him. They just kind of, they held on to that image.
So Johnny,
says
Johnny,
a lot about the power of marketing, doesn't it?
He was seen as too wholesome. Is that what you're saying? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was tired of that image too, and he wanted to say, "I'm a real person, mm-hmm. not the cardboard figure, not the goody two shoes
right.
you might see on the air here." So once again, just to summarize, Johnny, on David Cassidy, he has said that he does have some form of dementia, and the prognosis. Do we know? Has there been any mention of Alzheimer's, anything like that?
Yeah, that's all I know. Early onset dementia.
All right.
And what that exactly means, I don't know. But, you know, he has a history. He's always been very outspoken. He's always been outspoken about what he's done and what he didn't do. Like, if you read his biographies, he wrote a couple of autobiographies, and they're right to the point. He does not mince words. He will tell you that before the Partridge Family, when he was a teen, he did a lot of drugs, and he lost a friend to drugs, and he never touched drugs again. And all through the Partridge Family, he was not doing drugs or alcohol. He will tell you that. But he'll also come right out and say, but he did afterwards, not drugs, but alcohol, and that he's had a long time problem with alcohol and that he's a self-professed alcoholic. So it upsets him when people will say, oh, you know, David Cassidy was on drugs during the Partridge Family. He's like, if he were on drugs, he would tell you, because he's already said pretty much everything that he's done and when he's done it. Mm-hmm. But he's had that struggle his whole life, and, you know, his dad had a struggle with alcohol,
yes.
So
yes.
It's there in the
Jack
genes
Cassidy.
To deal with.
Mm-hmm. Jack Cassidy, I think
yeah.
He's also bipolar, and he had some dementia, too. So it is in the family genes. Johnny Ray Miller with us, author of When We're Singin', The Partridge Family and Their Music. You can get it. Once again, Johnny, the best route into getting a copy is what? Tell us again, please, the website?
WhenWe'reSingin.com. You can get it at the website at 25% off retail on the website at WhenWe'reSingin.com.
Heck of a deal for a great book. Shirley Jones, of course, David Cassidy's real-life stepmother, and, of course, they played mother and son on the Partridge Family show. Shirley Jones, well, what a background, what a glittering background, show business background. Shirley, can you please give us an update on Shirley Jones right now?
Yeah, Shirley actually, she lost her husband, Marty, about a year ago, and she's up and running, though. You know, she's out there still doing it. In fact, she's scheduled to appear at, I'm going to be at the MANC, the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, doing a presentation and book signing for the book, and she's going to be there as well.
Great.
And she's also scheduled to be at the Hollywood show in October. So she's out there meeting fans still and doing the autograph shows. She still guest stars on television shows, and she's a very she's a strong woman, and she's so personable. I think the thing that stands out more to me than anything about her, even the story of being at the grocery store checkout line, is when I went to her house and knocked on her door, and it was her answering the door. She was just so, you know, like she'd been your neighbor for 30 years and was just like, "Hi, John, come on in." And her dogs, you know, jumped on me and I greeted them. And she was just, it was like walking into the house of the Partridge Family.
She's the real deal. She's the real deal. Shirley Jones, by my fact here, she's now 82 years of age. And she had this to say, and you can comment on the veracity of it, but it is a quote. When she asked about being approached to do the Partridge Family, she said, quote, "When my agents came to me and presented it, the whole story idea to me, they said, if you do a series and it becomes a hit show, you will be that character for the rest of your life. And your film career will go into the toilet," which is what happened. She said this in a 2009 interview. But then she said, "But I have no regrets."
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
right.
your comment on that.
Yeah, she told me the exact same thing. And you could see it in her face. I interviewed her in person, and you could just see it all over her face how much she loved the Partridge Family. When I sat down, I had some songs, some obscure songs I wanted to see if she remembered that are not released, and I played them for her. They were from the Partridge Family, and I sat there watching her. All of a sudden, she started to sing along. And she looks at me, and she was like, "Where did you get these?" You know, she was so interested and excited. And she was very proud of the Partridge Family. One of the things that, you know, she'll say, exactly what you said, which is, you know, her film career would go in the toilet. But it was family that was the most important thing to her. So she had these little kids, and she was looking for a way to work and stay at home. And because of the timing of her small children, she felt that being away on movie sets was not something she could do and be a good mother. So if she could do a TV show, she could be home. And so despite what the agents and everybody said, she knew that they were probably right, but she didn't care. And then she ends up on a TV show that she absolutely loved.
Mm-hmm.
She actually said that, you know, you've heard this before, I'm sure, that she was approached to do the Brady Bunch, but she turned that one down. It was the fact that this had music in it that really appealed to her, and she could really relate to that character.
I was going to say, when she was married to Jack Cassidy in 74, they had, what, three sons, didn't they?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Sean, Patrick, and Ryan.
Right, right. Okay, if we can move on. Oh, one final quote. I'm pretty sure it's in your book. When she was asked whether she is, as Shirley Jones is, similar to her Partridge Family character, she said, "I am nowhere near as breezy and as uncomplicated as Mrs. Partridge." Okay.
She
sounds like a sweet, sweet, very intelligent, very obviously very talented lady. If we could move along, Johnny Ray Miller, to Danny Bonaducci. If we can remind us what character he played and what happened to him.
Yeah, he was the middle child, and I think one of the most interesting stories to me is he was so strong as a child actor that most of them credit him as the one who sold the pilot. Even Susan Day had said that to him once. He was so strong as a child actor, Shirley Jones said that, you know, he was one of two child actors that were the best she ever worked with, the other one being Ron Howard. He grew up to, you know, he's been in the news a lot. He did a lot of things. But he's a radio DJ, and he has a show in Seattle. And he's been doing that for quite some time. He worked in Philadelphia when I interviewed him. And I got to tell you, he was so much fun to talk to. He was just like the guy you want to go hang out with. I mean, he was just so real and just, you know, he had jokes left and right, and in between the jokes and the stories of the Partridge Family was all this sincerity about how much he loved the Partridge Family and how appreciative he was of that.
Well, it's a measure of his intelligence that he's in radio today, right, Johnny? Huh?
Right.
It's gotta be, huh?
Yeah.
He's Danny Bonaducci, I think 57 years of age right now, huh? So he's
that sounds about right.
Yeah, and he's having fun, and like you say, he was a centerpiece and maybe the main ingredient in getting the pilot sold and getting the whole enterprise, the whole project of the Partridge Family off the ground. Susan Day, you mentioned her just a bit ago. Please update us on Susan.
I don't know much about what she's up to. I know that she's kind of sort of, I think she's sort of semi-retired from show business, and she lives in New York, in upstate New York. She's very, the last interview I saw with her was an online thing, and she was very involved in her community and supporting, of all things, grassroots music out of her community. But she never does interviews, really, with about the Partridge Family, and I don't really know why, but, you know, that's okay. She was good friends with Dave Madden, and Dave Madden tried to get me the interview with her, and he emails me back 15 minutes later, and Dave Madden had a lot of, you know, sarcasm and a broad sense of humor, and he says, "Susan's not interested, but don't feel bad. It's probably the part where I told her you wanted photos of her naked from the waist up."
Oh, and, yeah. Well,
yeah, and at first my jaw drops, and then the last line of the email is, "That's okay. She wouldn't pose for me either."
Oh, so, well, let me pick my jaw.
You know, he just has this crazy sense of humor.
Well, Susan Day, to remind folks, she was one of the cast who, let's see, she, according to Shirley Jones, as you alluded to already, consistently refused to partake in any of the show reunions after the series ended. But she did star in L.A. Law, didn't she, in the late 1980s?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a big hit for her, probably. I mean, it would probably be construed as a bigger hit because it ran longer for her than the Partridge Family. She did a lot of made-for-TV movies, too, and some big-screen movies. And, of course, you know, she was a model in her young years. I saw her interviewed once, and they asked her, what is she asked about more, L.A. Law or Partridge Family? And she said, still, it's 50-50. So the Partridge Family, you know, it stays with her, whether she likes it or not.
You mentioned Dave Madden. Sadly, he and Suzanne, is it pronounced Crow? Crow?
Suzanne Crow, yeah.
Oh, yes. Dave Madden, Suzanne Crow, sadly no longer with us. Please please tell us, Dave Madden, about him, the role he played in the Partridge Family.
Yeah, he was their haphazard manager, and he was an actor who had he was pretty established at the time, and they were thrilled to have him on that. He had been on Laugh-In, and he had worked with Bob Claver before. He got along really well with all of the kids. They took to him, and he was really especially attached to Danny. Everybody knew that Danny had an abusive home life, and so Dave Madden became a really strong mentor and a personal friend to Danny. And they all kind of did. But Dave went on afterwards. He had a regular role on Alice that ran, I think that ran like 8 seasons. And one of the things I always found interesting is that he said to me, and I think he put it in his own autobiography, that 4 years on the Partridge Family and 8 years on Alice, and even though he was on Alice for 8 years, he never had the kind of relationships that were ongoing throughout his whole life, the way that the relationships held up for him with the actors from the Partridge Family.
Now, and, if we could, I'm sorry, Johnny, I don't mean to rush you through these things. We're trying to get as much in here as we can.
Oh, yeah.
All
sure.
of your stories are fascinating. And, folks, you can get these stories in book form, When We're Singing, The Partridge Family and Their Music, by the man we're talking with right now, Johnny Ray Miller. Johnny, if we could go on to Suzanne Crow now, another wonderful character in the Partridge Family.
Yeah, she died tragically at age 52 and, had a heart condition, some rare heart condition that nobody knew she had. I guess the story is she sat down on her couch one day and didn't get back up. It shocked everybody and, you know, her family was devastated. For the most part, she, got out of show business after her teenage years. She did some things through her teenage years and then, basically got married, had kids, and just lived a normal life.
She played Tracy, is that right? Tracy in the Partridge
Family? Yeah, the little tambourine player.
Yeah. Speaking of little, Brian Forster, Brian took on the role of pint-sized drummer Chris in the Partridge Family, right, after the original actor. Was that Jeremy, I can't pronounce his name, Gelbwax? Is that right?
Yeah, Jeremy Gelbwax,
yeah.
He, Gelbwax was sort of taken off the show by his parents, who his dad got a job to move him back east, and in came Brian Forster, and Brian had a long history of show business people in his family. His mom was an actress, and his dad and his grandfather was Alan Napier, who played Alfred on Batman, and he came into the fold and finished, you know, season 2, 3, and 4. Went on to become left show business after that. Went on to become a race car driver. And now is married and lives a kind of quiet life in Northern California outside San Francisco.
A little drummer is now burning down the racetrack, huh? That's it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, we're going to take a break, Johnny Ray Miller. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the music, which is so important to the Partridge Family story.
Yeah.
Which of these actors, which of these characters was actually playing an instrument or singing? We'll tell you about this. We'll lift the veil. Johnny Ray will give it to us all. And going into break here, let's hear another one of those big Partridge Family. Yes, sir. I think I love you.
All at once I wake up from something that keeps knocking at my brain. Before I go insane, I hold my pillow to my head and spring up in my bed, screaming out the words I dread. I think I love you.
Ford set out to build the best truck ever, and the 2017 F-150 has more than lived up to expectations. Visit River Valley Ford in Baldwin today and see for yourself what everyone's been talking about. We know trucks, and we're ready to help. Shop, compare, and find out why so many of your friends and family choose River Valley Ford of Baldwin.
Find out why more people come here to River Valley Ford. River Valley Ford.
This is Tom from TimelyExpressions.com on KLBB Radio. Many of you have told me, I don't need a gift right now. You know, that's okay. I don't want you to buy something you don't need. What's the point in that? But when you do need that special personalized embroidered item, blanket, shirt, cap, whatever, give me a call at 612-414-3674 or check out our website. We can make sure they know how much you care, even though they won't know how you did it.
Call 651-275-1220. The Wolf Brewing Company. All request and dedication show with Stan Turner is on Club 1220 KLBB.
And this hour, we kind of break format, but all the requests have to do with, yes, the story of the Partridge Family, that great TV musical sitcom from the early 70s. Their wonderful music. No better guy to tell us the whole story than Johnny Ray Miller, author of When We're Singing, the Partridge Family and Their Music. And that is a book you can buy and put right up there on your shelf, and you will love it. Johnny, before we talk about the music and who was doing what or who wasn't doing playing, as they might have appeared to be on the air, what about behind-the-scenes hijinks or practical jokes or gags on the shooting set? Can you tell us any of those?
Yeah, some of the ones I can tell you are have been told a lot. They love to tell these stories. Danny's just got a load of them. One of the ones he tells, one of the most famous stories, is how one day David got so frustrated with Danny blowing his lines around a scene around the bus that Danny hopped on the bus, David closed the door, and drove off the set and started driving around Hollywood. And at some point, all of these girls rushed the bus, and it was sort of a moment when they all kind of looked, when they both looked at each other and thought, you know, wow, are we in trouble? And they were escorted back to the studio. I love that one. And they have other ones. Another one that I really kind of like that Danny tells had to do with Susan Day dumping a quart of milk over his head on the set one day because he kept blowing his lines. And Danny's memory of that, you know, Danny is just a guy who, he's so much fun, and he's just not this kind of superficial character that, you know, you might think he is. He's very deep. And he said to me that story meant so much to him, and is, it's his favorite story because it was the kind of a joke that you play on someone who you treat like an adult. And he said it was a moment where he looked around the table and thought, wow, you know, they're treating me like I'm an adult. And so it developed his bond with them on sort of an adult level, at least in his mind.
Johnny, are there any outtakes of them blowing their lines or any screw-ups on the set?
Yeah, there's this, you know, it's not out there to be purchased anywhere, but there's this blooper reel. They used to do this thing at Christmas where they would, the camera guys would get together and put together a blooper reel, and there's a lot of funny stuff, you know, Shirley, who never blew her lines, twisting her words around sometimes, and the faces that they would make. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, that reminds me. I used to work at a television station, and every Christmas they'd put together a blooper reel. That's where I would leave the room, if you know what I mean.
Right,
I couldn't stand to see me doing that again. Oh, boy. In any case, let's talk about the characters, their music, who played, who actually sang or played instruments or both. Let's start with David Cassidy. Now, he was kind of dealt out of the deck. He originally was not tapped to sing, but go ahead and tell us the story.
Yeah, right. No, he was, you know, he was really into music of his era, and he could play the guitar, and he had been, you know, he had sang, and I think, he had bands along the way as a kid, teenager. But whenever, at the same time, Wes Farrell was sort of formulating his plan, wondering if David Cassidy could sing, David Cassidy was also feeling silly doing the lip syncing and goes to Bob Claver and says, hey, you know, can I possibly audition to do this? Because, you know, I feel really stupid doing this lip syncing. So, you know, I don't think David knew maybe at that time really just what a great voice he had. And that was sort of a... you know, it was a time when he figured out what he had, and yes, he really sang, he really played. Other than the episodes where he's lip syncing, you can spot them in a second. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a harmonized sound. There is no lead vocal. It's all sort of a harmonic sound. There's five or six of those.
Is he lip syncing to his own songs? Is that what it is, or is he lip syncing?
Yeah, I guess, you know, let me clarify. In the beginning, in the five or six episodes where he was officially just lip-syncing, he was lip-syncing to the voice of the blended harmonic background vocalists who were singing. David was not singing yet.
Ron Hicklin and those others, right?
Yeah. But once they figured out David could sing, he went into the studio and made recordings. But how they recorded them for television was that they would bring a playback, you know, in a tape, and they would do a playback on the set, and he would lip sync to his own voice for the sake of making the videos.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So most of what we see him doing, he really is singing, with the exception of a couple episodes. Okay. Let's go on to Shirley Jones. We know her stagecraft, her talents. She was doing her own singing for sure.
Yeah, and that's a question that I always get asked a lot about. People are always confused about whether she sang or not. When she signed for the show, you know, she was the only star. David Cassidy really wasn't known yet. And so she had major star appeal, and everyone knew she could sing because, you know, musical theater was her thing, and she had starred in all of those musicals, Oklahoma and Music Man. And I think that in the beginning, everybody kind of thought that in some way she was going to be, if there was a lead singer, it was going to be her. But once they discovered David, and Shirley told me this herself, and they saw what they had there and the demographic that they were appealing to, they went to Shirley and said, you know, hey, do you understand that, you know, we're going to do this, and are you okay with it? And she was completely supportive of it.
Mm-hmm.
So she took a back seat, but because the contracts were already drawn up and executed the way they were done, all those albums were required to say starring Shirley Jones and featuring David Cassidy. So right. All of them said that all the way through.
Right. Okay.
And she did really sing. She was on, they brought her into the studio, and she recorded on her own separate track. And what they would do, where that came in really handy, was that they might mix her on the albums really low, but her voice wasn't part of the sound that was created with those four background vocalists that actually sang most of the backgrounds in the Partridge Family. But they used that track anyway, and when they did the TV videos, they would push that track up when they would do close-ups of Shirley. So, yeah, if ever there was a box set that would come out, you know, we all wish that all this unreleased music, there's over 35 songs that have never been released, and really good songs. People wish and fans hope for the TV versions, too, which were all mono, and they're all mixed differently, and they all feature more of Shirley's voice in them.
Okay. Good old TV trickery. So the others we see, they appear to be, the other characters, the kids, appear to be singing and playing instruments, but they're not, right?
Right. No, none of them were singing.
How did they cover up the fact that that they couldn't play instruments? Did they have to do any special camera tricks or anything like that?
Yeah, they did. One of the producers told me that in the early stages there was the use of hand doubles for some of them. David Cassidy and Danny Bonaducci tell this great story about how, you know, they gave Danny this bass to play, and he had no idea how to play a bass. And one day David Cassidy, who knew guitars, gets so frustrated watching Danny strum the bass that he tells us, you pluck a bass, you don't strum it. And so Danny actually learned how to do it from David, which I think is kind of funny, because years and years later, they make a bet, this wasn't too long ago either, that Danny could not learn the bass and really play a Partridge Family song. And, you know, Danny never turns down a bet. So he goes out and he learns the bass enough to play Doesn't Somebody Want to Be Wanted, and he gets on stage with David Cassidy and comes out in red crushed velvet and plays the bass and sings Doesn't Somebody Want to Be Wanted.
And he plucks the bass, he doesn't strum it, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay,
right.
Okay. So the rest of the noise, rest of the great music is coming from a studio, a group of first call grade A studio musicians, variously known as the Wrecking Crew. And then you mentioned four strong vocalists whom we never see, but here, thinking they are the Partridge Family. Tell us first about those four vocalists, please. As briefly as you can. I'm sorry we're starting to lose time here. And then the Wrecking Crew, too.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Well, you know, these vocalists were sort of considered the Wrecking Crew of session vocalists. They were on everything during that time, and uncredited, because that was the deal that was made. That was just the deal they signed to do. They were the top four vocalists, probably, of all of Hollywood. They played on everything. They played on TV commercials. They played on theme songs like Love American Style and, you know, some of the theme songs you would hear from that era. They recorded records for even the Carpenters, who are known for their vocal overdubbing, and they sing supposedly only, it's them only on their albums. They had a relationship with these guys, and on some albums, they actually brought these guys in and, you know, they sang even with the Carpenters. So they were all over the place playing on records, big hits of the day, doing background vocalists for all of them.
Yeah, Elvis, Ron Hicklin is one of those vocalists, right?
Yeah.
Ron Hicklin. Now,
yeah.
It's my, Johnny, it's my understanding that Ron Hicklin, in the breakout hit for Gary Lewis and the Playboys, This Diamond Ring, I've looked at many summaries of that song and who did what, and it says vocal support by Ron Hicklin for Gary Lewis's vocals. I'm thinking that it was Ron Hicklin doing the lead vocals on that piece, huh?
I think you're probably right. He tells a story that had to do with the Monkees and that later kind of spawned into a Partridge Family thing, which was that in the early phases of the Monkees, you know, they weren't all singing in those early records. I think it was just two of them. And it was Ron Hicklin and Bobby Hart and Tommy Boyce, who produced the Monkees, that sang on, I think, the first song, their first hit. And Ron Hicklin was called the Ringer, he told me, which meant that he was uncredited. He was just in there to enhance the sound. But he, at the time, I think, was the top vocalist that everyone knew in Hollywood that they would go to. And then pretty soon, he knew all the vocalists, so they would go to him not only for his voice, but to recruit the others. So he was kind of the top dog in the beginning in those early years, putting together these little teams of background vocalists that would play on these different records.
Remember that name.
And for him, those four on the Partridge Family, he felt were the best of the best. In fact, he told me that of all the things he did, and he did hundreds of records, the Partridge Family is at the top of what he is most proud of.
Wow. We got to ask you that Partridge Family bus. Where is that old jalopy? Where is that thing today? Is it in some museum, or did it go to the scrapyard?
I'll tell you, It's still completely unknown where it is.
It's not your backyard, is it, Jerry?
Yeah, I think it's probably the scrapyard is where it went.
Okay.
But what's funny is it was so elusive and rare that nobody even knew where it went after the Partridge Family. So we uncovered some of that for the book. It was painted over, and it was used in Apple's Way, a short-lived TV series, in one episode. And it's the interesting thing about the bus, I found myself a restoration specialist who was obsessed with buses, of all things, and especially the Partridge Family bus, to fill me in on how to identify these things. Turns out the bus model that was the Partridge Family model is so rare that it's unlikely that you would even find the model to recreate the bus today. That's how rare the model was.
Think about on eBay what that would go for. Wow. And finally, we're just about out of time, John. I got to ask you this. There is an album cover that was never released. It's in the form of a TV dinner. And Shirley Jones' head is coming out of the mashed potatoes, and David Cassidy's head is popping out of the peas and carrots. I think I understand why it was never released.
Huh? Right. You know, that is one of my favorite stories in all the book, in the whole book, because I, sparing you the details, found the original graphic artist who worked on the Partridge Family albums, and she had this great fun personality. Her name was Mary English, and she worked at a music agency, and she tells the story, she brought it up, I had no idea it existed, that it was her favorite Partridge Family album design because it just seemed so weird, and she said they always let her experiment with whatever she wanted, and she just thought it was so brilliant because, you know, it was, they were on a TV show, and kids watch the TV show, and they eat TV dinners, so she just thought it was perfect. But to hear her tell the story about how she brought it in, and David Cassidy's head is popping out of the vegetable mix, and she presents it, you know, the executives just looked at her, kind of shuddered, and just went, yeah, no.
Yeah. I wonder what Shirley thought about the mashed potatoes she was getting. Well, in any case, Johnny Ray Miller, this has been delightful, as is your book, When We're Singing, the Partridge Family and Their Music. One more time, where do we get the book?
We get the book at whenwersingin.com. And I don't know if you have any listeners near the Cleveland area, but I'm going to be doing a presentation at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on August 29th, if I can plug that, too.
You can, and you just did, and we're glad you did. Johnny, thank you so much. It's been a delight chatting with you. We're out of time. Okay, brother, keep writing books, will you? Okay.
Hey, thanks for having me. I enjoyed this so much, I can't tell you.
Thank you so much. We did, too. That's it, folks, for today. Bobby J., thank you for your usual grade-A work over there. And, yes, our guest, Johnny Ray Miller, Stan Turner here. We'll catch you tomorrow with our regular format, all your requests and dedications. Have a great day.